Good morning. Welcome to the Negotiators podcast. My name is Derek Arden, and today I have Godfrey Lancashire with me. Godfrey is the has been the president of the Credit Services Association, a fellow of the Institute of Credit Management, and a visiting lecturer at the Open University, Warwick University, and Manchester University. Today I want to talk to Godfrey about his role as a private detective, and he also worked as a franchisor, selling franchisees, helping people in his industry. Good morning, Godfrey. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Derek. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Godfrey, as a private detective, you must have had some pretty stiff challenges. How did it work, and what was the most difficult thing you had to do?
Well, that's a double question. So first off, the big difference in the private sector is, of course, you must remember that you're only as good as an ordinary member of the public. You only have the powers of a private individual. You do not have access to police databases. You cannot produce a warrant card and ask people awkward questions, and they would have no obligation to tell you in the private sector. So you've got to be a little bit more imaginative and understand all the aspects of body language and negotiation skills and listening skills. As to the most difficult case that perhaps I worked on, there are many, but I could give you an example of perhaps a dangerous case. It's a little bit out of the ordinary. We were asked by a corporate client to help them repossess an industrial estate that they own. So you can picture the scene with an industrial estate and maybe a dozen or more units. And it was being occupied by a group of travellers who very often just pitch up and pitch camp, and then of course you need to ask them nicely to leave with all the legal paperwork. And a solicitor acting for our corporate client came with me. He wanted to see what happened, and we turned up at the industrial estate, and we were in the car, and just as I was getting out of the car, we were approached by two of the travellers pointing shotguns at me. And I said to the solicitor, just stay in the car and I will deal with this. And I got out, and clearly an open body language and a nice smile, thinking, crikey, or words to that effect, what's going to happen next? But with some conversation, I explained what we needed to do, and they readily understood, of course, as they do. And I said, I need to serve some notices on each of your 20 travelling caravans. And they said, no, you're not going to do that, but we will do it for you. And they went round with my help, and we served the notices on all the caravans. And the job was done, and they knew they had to move off within 24 hours, and that was fine. And when I got back to my car, I couldn't find the solicitor. And it was only after a couple of moments that I realised he was lying on the ground, flat out under the car, scared out of his mind. He had no idea that a little conversation with the right body language would produce a result. So maybe that's a very unusual case.
So the solicitor was under the car hiding. That's amazing. Although I have to say, if someone was pointing a shotgun at me, I think I might have wanted to do that anyway. So what you're telling me there is, even in the most difficult of circumstances, when people are scared, if you use open body language, if you recognise the issues that the other side's facing, then anything can be negotiated.
Well, there's always a way. Sometimes you give more than you get, but in this particular case, they knew the score, and I knew that they knew the score, and it was by treating them with respect. And I think the message really is, you treat everybody that you have to deal with as they would wish to be treated.
Absolutely, there's a great lesson there for everybody listening. You said to me when we've spoken earlier that you had some funny situations. Can you share any of those with us?
Well, there's one that I recall where most of the work we did was with large corporations. clients, but of course it all boils down to people. And there was a managing director of a large corporate client who came to me in confidence and said that he was very worried about his wife and her recent behavior. She'd been whispering, there were secret conversations, there were phones going off at very odd times of day and night. She was disappearing out of the house without much conversation, and he was terribly worried, and I guess your listeners will understand why he might have been worried. So he asked if we could put a surveillance operation to find out, in fact, the reality of what his wife was up to. And I wouldn't normally have done this, but as he was the MD of a very valued corporate client, we agreed to do it. We had the skills. And we did, on one evening, fairly soon after, follow his wife in her car, and she went out into the countryside to a very discreet pub miles from anywhere, and we parked, and she went into the pub, and we followed inside, and she sat at a table on her own. But very soon afterwards, another lady joined her, and we managed to overhear a little of the conversation, enough to discover what was going on. So we reported back to our client and said, "Do you really want to know the truth?" And he said, "Yes, I've paid you, and I do." And we said, "Are you prepared for the consequences?" And he said, "Yes, of course I am." So we said, "Well, we have discovered the truth that your wife and a very close lady friend of hers are actually planning your surprise 40th birthday party."
No.
What did he had to obviously keep the secret and take the consequences himself.
Wow, and I guess he kept that secret that he'd employed you, etc. That wouldn't have done his marriage any good after she was planning his 40th birthday party. Wow.
Exactly, and I think the lesson there, which we will come back to, I'm sure, is you can never assume, and you always need to get to the facts and check the facts and the assumptions.
Of course, as we've discussed, assumptions are there to make asses out of you and me, because assumptions come from how you see it rather than the other person sees it. So discovery and asking questions is crucial to that. You told me a story once about someone who claimed to a court that he had no assets. And I think you sat outside their house for a while just to see what happened. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it was a very interesting case, and again, I learned lessons from it, but we were acting for a major financial institution, actually, and they had a private individual who, if I recall, owed about £1 million, and he had sworn a statement on oath to say he had no assets, and the client didn't believe him, and in fairness, looking at the file, which we were given, neither did we. So we did. We watched outside his house, which was down in the West Country at a holiday resort, one morning. But a male fitting his description actually came out of the house next door, not the house where we were told he lived. So we thought that was a little strange, and we went back and did a land registry check and discovered that actually he owned the house where we had seen him coming out from. So at least we knew that he owned one property. And I guess some gut instinct took over, and that should never be ignored. So we did a land registry check on the original house, and although he didn't own that, we then did a land registry on the house the other side. And guess what? He owned that as well. And so we made some inquiries in the area, and he was known to be converting properties into holiday homes, which made sense because it was in a lovely part of the West Country. So I took a little bit of a flyer, and the street had 12 houses. And we did a land registry check on all 12, and guess what? He owned all of them, apart from the one which he had provided as his address. So it was a huge result, and it just proved that actually going out into the field and checking facts with your own eyes and ears very often is the key. And to rely on just computer information and paper files is not always the answer. So again, it was a combination of some experience, gut instinct. People said you were lucky, but of course we created our own luck by being out in the field watching with our own eyes and ears in the first place. But we certainly got a result, and the client said, well, what should we do? And I said, well, you've got two choices, really. You've certainly got him for perjury because he had sworn a statement on oath. But actually, you now know you can put charges over a lot of assets to recover your money. But my recommendation was that they went back to him and said, it's about 12 months since we had your last statement. I think we'd like a fresh statement and give him a little bit more rope to hang himself. So that is, in fact, what they did. And I think they then negotiated their way out of it.
Wow. So the learning point there is go and look for yourself and see what's actually happening, not believe what the information is on the computers, on the land registry and things like that. Just go and look and you'll never know what you'll find.
Exactly.
Now, I remember you did some interviewing for people, and I think you looked at, when people were taking people on, assessing people whether they were a drug risk, and I think you did some things in Glasgow, you told me about at one stage, for a company interviewing prospective staff.
Yes, this was at a very senior level, and there was a very senior bank official, actually, who had moved companies and had allegedly taken his client list, his former employer's client list, with him in breach of covenants and his employment contract. But it was very difficult to prove. So we actually took a suite of rooms in a hotel in Glasgow and set up as being executive headhunters, interviewing for other senior banking positions. And this fellow was clearly very full of himself and had a very large ego. And he came to interview very soon after he'd already moved bank, but looking to move to bigger and better things. And in interview, he explained that, yes, he could provide this, this, and this. And we said, well, how was that? And he said, well, because I've got the client list and so on and so on. And I said, well, isn't that in breach of your former employment contract? And he said, oh, never mind about that. I've got all this and I can bring all these people on board. And the interview continued. And what he didn't know, of course, that it was all on audio and we had all his confessions, as they were really, on tape. So we were able to go to our client and say, well, here's the evidence you'd need. They asked what our recommendation was, and we said, well, clearly you've got reputation at stake, and I wouldn't necessarily go public with this, because after all, if the clients moved, they probably moved of their own volition, maybe because they were unhappy with you or they preferred him. It doesn't matter, but they did move. But what you could do is to use this evidence as a warning to any of your other executives that if it happened again, you would take the most serious action. And in fact, the client phoned their peer in the competitor's banking operation and said, look, we know what's happened. We take a pretty dim view of this, but we just want to know that we are aware of it. And they used it as a big internal warning to all other senior executives. But again, that was playing on somebody's ego and getting the information out of him.
Yes, amazing when you ask questions what people will tell you. And he had no idea that he was being set up at all, presumably.
None at all, no.
Just changing the subject for a minute, you ran a franchise where you taught people to do this sort of thing. What were the biggest difficulties in running a franchise operation?
Absolutely, without question, the biggest point to get over to new franchisees is that they are not buying a steady income stream. they are buying into a proven model, and a good franchisor will provide them with all the training and know-how, but it's still absolutely up to the franchisee to go out and win their local business and do the marketing and do the networking and do the sales and be seen and be proactive, not just sit back. They are not buying a job. They are not buying an employee contract. And that is the hardest thing for somebody who's probably been in employment, paid employment, for a long time. They have this great idea of wanting to run their own business, and they see franchising as a way into it, which it can be. But they forget that actually they are going to be their own self-employed business person, and they have to go out and win the business. And to sit back and expect it all to fall on their lap is the last thing that it would be. So that is the biggest message to get across right from day one when you first meet a prospective franchisee, is to say, we will give you the know-how, we will give you the training, but it is up to you. And if you don't go out and win the business, you will not have any money.
And out of the 100 or so people that bought the franchisees with your warnings, how many did actually go out and sell and make a lot of money at it? 20%?
Yeah, I would think that's pretty fair, Derek, actually. I was going to say it's well under half, and probably a quarter would be realistic.
Well, I remember when I did a bit of speaking for you, that was came across pretty clearly, because what we were trying to tell them to do or teach them to do was sell, influence and negotiate. And of course, the key thing there is to get off your backside and go out and network and go to breakfast meetings and things like that, which most people often are reluctant to do. And anyone listening to this knows that they must go out and meet clients, see people and network. Godfrey, we're coming to the end of this interview, which has been fascinating, and I thank you very much for it. If there was one last tip that you'd give anybody listening to this, going out into the world of business, what would it be?
Well, that's a very wide question, Derek, but I think if we try and pick out the key messages from the two aspects of this conversation, firstly, on the detective world, and it does fall into the wider business world, is never assume. Focus on your listening skills. You pick an awful lot up by just sitting back and listening. And go out and check things in the field. Don't always believe what you see in a paper file. If we turn to the franchising world, and somebody wants to be their own business person through franchising, my message would be, check that the franchisor is a member of the British Franchise Association, that they do have the right credentials. Check that they have a good operating and training manual that they can see before they pay their money. And above all, ask to speak and go and see existing franchisees. And don't just go and see one or two franchisees who may be the franchisor's favourite and they've just given a couple of names. Ask for the whole list of all franchisees, pick any at random and go and see them and see exactly how they feel about the operation.
Godfrey, that's been a fantastic interview, fantastic insights. Now, anyone listening to this needs a private detective, needs some advice on franchising. How do they get hold of you?
I would say the easiest is in the professional world is go onto LinkedIn and you will pick up all my details.
Fantastic. Godfrey Lancashire, thank you very much for joining the Negotiators podcast.
It's a pleasure, Derek. Thank you.